Episode 140 von Win Today Hockey O'Clock. Lyle Seitz, Head of Hockey Operations, Win Today Ice Hockey League.
We were on cloud nine about last year's playoffs, from the sold out buildings and the entertainment value to the way the game officials performed their duties. So from our standpoint, we were extremely happy, but it's a big group effort. It's not just the referees. If the coaches aren't working with the refs, or the players aren't working with the refs, or vice versa, that whole system breaks down very, very quickly.
Und Lukas Gradke, Buchmacher, Win Today.
Sport und Sportwetten und die Buchmacherei, die gehen schon sehr weit zurück. Von was für einem Zeitraum sprechen wir da?
Oh, das ist eine ausgezeichnete Frage. Ich würde fast meinen, das muss so im zweiten Jahrhundert schon bereits stattgefunden haben in etwa. Es stellt sich quasi da der grundlegenden Frage, wer ist besser oder wer macht was besser? Das ist natürlich unter zwei Kontrahenten, ist das einfach zum Ausmachen, wer besser ist. Da bräuchte es vielleicht einen dritten Unabhängigen, der quasi die Stärkeneinschätzung übernimmt und daraufhin die Wetten. Und diese Fragestellung gab es quasi schon immer. Wer ist stärker, wer ist schneller in irgendetwas, wer springt weiter? Wer weiß nicht, wirft den Stein weiter als der andere. Und damit beschäftigt sich die Buchmacherei natürlich grundlegend von Anfang an.
Win Today Hockey O'Clock.
In diesem Augenblick wird es jetzt richtig hitzig. Yeah, und die Scheibe kollert über die Linie. Yeah.
Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Das ist unglaublich, was die hier zelebrieren.
Nice move, another nice move.
Es ist nichts weniger als eine kleine Revolution, die in Folge 140 von Win Today Hockey O'Clock erwartet. Denn es ist das erste Mal, dass in einer regulären Folge der Podcast dann auch tatsächlich mit Wort, Audio und Bild versehen ist. Und Bild ist in diesem Fall ganz wichtig, denn wir werden im folgenden Gespräch sehr viel über diverse Clips sprechen. Für all diejenigen, die das jetzt im gewohnten Podcast-Feed zum gewohnten Termin hören, einfach in den Shownotes dieses Podcasts ein klein wenig runterscrollen und dort gibt's dann die Videovariante dieses Podcasts. Without further ado, very, very happy to be finally doing this. We talked about it for a long time. Now it's finally possible. It's no one else here than Head of Hockey Operations of the Winter Day Ice Hockey League, Lyle Seitz. So glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Lyle, it's been a short summer. You've been here for a couple of days now. How was the summer? How was the off-season? Granted, there hardly ever is an off-season for you guys.
Yeah, there's no off-season as far as work goes, but obviously there's an off-season as far as the games go, and we're ready to go. It's and very exciting. There's two exciting times of the year now, because we're getting ready to go, and then, of course, playoff time. So short summer in the sense of it went by quick, but we're ready to roll.
We're recording this conversation 2.5 weeks out of the games getting real. We're in the midst of preseason. We're going to look back a little. We look forward to the season, rules emphasis. We're going to talk about the Champions Hockey League. We're going to premiere kind of new and old feature category at the same time. Lots to be going through, but I know you and your team already had your first highlight of the year. Ref camp in Kapfenberg, the entire team coming together, the entire team working on their craft. What's your resume on ref camp?
I would say, and I've been here enough years now to know, our best camp ever. And I say that because, right from Tom and how he designed the camp and worked with the guys and the content he had in the camp to the whole spirit of the team, it's I've never seen it like that. They're truly a team, and it's kind of cool to see how it doesn't matter what nationality, it doesn't matter what age, it doesn't matter, it's just one big team. And to see that start right now, like you say, 2.5 weeks before the season is very big for us.
The interesting thing about refereeing is there's always going to be controversy, there's always going to be things that the people we'll discuss, maybe even question. But after having seen the Stanley Cup playoffs, and I don't want to really be candid here, but after the shitstorm the NHL referees got from the media, how happy are you with the way we got through our playoffs. If you look at what happened in the National Hockey League.
Oh, we were on cloud nine about last year's playoffs, from the, you know, the sold out buildings and the entertainment value to the way the game officials performed their duties. So from our standpoint, we were extremely happy, but that's a, it's a big group effort. It's not just the referees. If the coaches aren't working with the refs, or the players aren't working with the refs, or vice versa, that whole system breaks down very, very quickly. So, you know, my hat's off to all the teams involved in playoffs, and for sure, Bozzano and Salzburg in the finals, to see that caliber of hockey and that skill set and then go to seven games in overtime. That's just an incredible feat. And so for the referees, they just had to fit into the mold. They didn't have to, you know, be front and center. They didn't have to do anything special. They just had to call what they had to call and leave everything else, because both teams were very disciplined in the finals. And for the most part, teams were very disciplined throughout playoffs.
As of right now, you're still touring league teams. You're talking to head coaches. You're talking to players with a letter on their chest. So the usual things that go on around this time of the year. But in a couple of weeks' time, you're going to return to your kind of natural habitat, the Situation Room, at the very least on game days. If people out there have never heard of the Situation Room or have never seen the Situation Room, you brought along a photo that kind of illustrates what's going on there, but what really is going on there?
Well, it's Grand Central Station is what it is. So, you know, obviously the games are coming in, and then from there, we are sending everything out. So if you could break it down to whatever means you want within the Situation Room, but if you just look at game officials, we're clipping, you know, good calls, bad calls, non-calls. We have supervisors in the building. They're live on WhatsApp. So those clips are going to them, the people in the arenas. So we're working in real time. Everything's live all the time. So by the time a period ends, you know, that period has come to a conclusion, and everybody in the building should know. You know, in some special cases, we try not to do this, but it might be talking to the game officials. If we look at coaches, you know, what are they doing? We're looking at systems. We're looking at what are teams doing. We look at habits. I can tell you every single player. I can tell you if he goes down soft or if he works battles through everything, if he has a real tendency to be injured, or is never injured, and now he's injured. And then obviously, and what everybody thinks the Situation Room is DOPS. For sure it is. But that's the end goal, not the start. There's a lot in between.
How long has this infrastructure that we've been looking at been in place?
I would definitely 10 years. I would say about 10 years.
Anniversary.
You know, we redid it all 2 years ago. This will be our second year. You know, everything, you know, technology and everything's moving. We had to do the same thing, but it's our lifeline. To be honest with you, I don't think the league could go on without it any longer, because everybody knows everything's in real time. Everybody's being watched and everything's being seen.
Now, if we look at the Situation Room, and if we pull up a discussion that happened last year, especially during the playoffs, where the calls get made and who's involved in getting the calls right, because some officials were seen on their cell phone, maybe obviously talking to you in a Situation Room. How does a fan have to think about the process of getting it right? I'll keep it in broad terms.
Well, yeah, you're referring specifically to goals or a review of a goal.
Correct.
They're certainly not ordering pizza or, you know, asking for ice for their cold beer, but they are performing a very important part of the game, because that is the difference maker. If we miss a penalty or call the weak one, we don't want that, but that doesn't alter a game like a goal would alter a game. And so come playoff time, we just felt there was a great importance to it. What we really were was just another set of eyes for the referees. And what people don't realize is the referees are going up and down the ice. They're full of adrenaline. They're running, you know, sometimes like just trying to catch their breath because they've been skating so hard and stuff. Now we expect them or want them to come to a penalty box, look at a camera, and slow everything down. In the Situation Room, it's already slowed down. We don't have that adrenaline. We don't have that emotion. So what we were able to provide for the referees, and we were certainly not the ones deciding, we were the ones aiding them in what is the best outcome for that situation.
Is that it going to be there for regular season games as well? Or is it something that you guys save for the playoffs because it's that much more important at the time?
It's always important. You know, September 15th or the last game of the season is still a potential 3 points for the team. So you can ask any coach, they're all important. However, it comes down to what can we actually do with the people we have, and we can't do it all regular season. But on the other side of it, we like the system we have where we leave it with the referees, because believe it or not, all those video goal judges, and everyone's looked at and everyone's analyzed, and on Mondays we put everything together. The vast majority of time, and I don't mean 9 out of 10 times, I mean 9.9 out of 10 times, the referees did get it right. There is times where it's judgment. It could go either way, who's right, who's wrong. And there is the odd time, and you could probably count on your hands in the whole season the amount of times maybe we would determine it was wrong. But that very seldom happens.
You know what? I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but we're going to challenge our viewers in this case a little later on. But viewers is a good keyword, because you had a look at the Situation Room. You're lucky enough to get all the games in a Situation Room, but you at home can get the games in a Situation Room too. If you just log on to wintoday.at and create an account there, you can look at all the league games live, as does the Situation Room. Pretty big deal if you want to see a lot of hockey. And of course, the games start on September 15th. Wintoday.at is the URL to log on to. Getting closer to the season means games are getting real and games are getting officiated again. Not that preseason games don't get right. officiated, but each and every year there are rule changes. This year, not so much, but there are different sets and points of emphasis. When heading, as we are right now, into the season 23-24, what can fans expect?
That is a great question, Martin, because although the Ice League is not going through any great rule changes by any means.
Another league is, and we'll tackle that
league
later.
Is, yes. What you say is referred to as emphasis is extremely important. And we start with the we started with the referees this past weekend, and then we have a captain's meeting and a coach's meeting, and it's discussed with everybody. So ultimately we get to the result we want, but not by the referees doing it by themselves or the referees having a choice in this matter. This is a league issue. So what we found, and of course the Ice Hockey League has a great medical procedure and we analyze all injuries. What we found last year was the majority of our injuries, people might think it was fighting or checking to the head or whatever people may think, was actually stick fouls, stick situations. And that was over 50% of all injuries were caused by the stick. Now, we're not going to get
funny,
that
to zero. It's funny that you mentioned it. I just attended a preseason game, two players out with wrist injuries.
With wrist, yeah. And the thing is, sometimes it looks like it's nothing. Or to a fan, it was nothing. Or it's so easy to miss as well. But that quick little chop, especially if it's in the wrist area or in the back of the knee.
So we're talking right around here.
Right above the glove, right below the elbow pad. They should meet up. But of course, players use short cuff gloves now because they've got better hands that way. But there are players know where the vulnerable area is. That's probably a better way to explain it. And when they're going after those areas, that is a cause for concern.
You're tracking all the injuries. You're tracking all the calls. You're also tracking the kind of missed calls that should have had a penalty on them. Is the stick foul in general the most difficult to officiate to see?
If you wanted to break down any one shift, you could find a stick foul or stick fouls any shift. It's which ones to call. And that becomes the contest. That becomes the tough thing for the referees is, you know, what do we want to call and what do we want to let go? And it's a tough situation because for referees, they're scanning. They're not looking at that stick. They're not looking at that player that's potentially going to get hit. They're scanning. So we teach the referees, it's more of what are you doing with your stick? And then obviously, where is it located versus, you know, you can't follow a stick because then you're missing nine other players. And so right now we're kind of in that, area where at the beginning of the season, we are, well, throughout the season, we're going to maintain stick fouls. But the point is the players got to adjust and the referees got to adjust. And I say that
and the coaches
because,
too.
And the coaches, but it takes a group effort. And so we have expectations for the players, but we know it's not going to start and it's going to be perfect because old habits are hard to break. And we also have expectations for the refs. But again, old habits are hard to break and we got to feed our way into this.
The great thing about you being here is that you brought along a couple of clips. We are going to look at four different clips where there is a stick foul. It's awfully hard to see when we run it the first time. So the second time, you'll have to direct your attention to the little highlighted circle. The first instance that we're going to look at happened in a Pustertal and Linz game. I think it was early in the year, and we have to look at 85 Linz, Michael Hager.
So that one's a little easier, Martin, just because the stick come out of the hands. But that is also part of slashing. When a stick is knocked out, it doesn't mean it's an automatic penalty. But the difference on that one was it was knocked out of his hands and it was up at the player's hands, not down at the blade or the hosel, the beginning of the stick. That player from Pustertal can't say he was battling for the puck. He was battling for the player's hands on that.
How big of an indication for a penalty is a player losing his stick?
It's all location, all location. So what we've taught the referees, and this is what the players will be told not to do, it's horizontal. So if you're bringing your stick up and you're running it horizontal, meaning waist level coming across in that direction or in that situation, you know, it's coming up and maybe slightly down, but it's up in the player's hands. It's all to do with how is your stick traveling.
You know what? We'll cue that clip up just once more. Let's have another look at what we've just seen. And again, a reminder for all the listeners out there,
see,
you want to log on to the video to be able to see this.
See, the referee's not standing on the camera angle we have. Like, he's not seeing what we're seeing because obviously he's not up in the stand. So we probably have one down low, and then we obviously have one on the other side of the ice. They're looking through the back of those players. It's 100% how that player's stick traveled. I'm guessing the players probably couldn't even ultimately see right where the contact point was because it was going right at the direction of the boards, the play was.
The location of the referees is something that we'll talk about within the next clip. It happened during a Klagenfurt-Linz game, and it happened right after the play started at the face-off circle. We'll have a look. It's happening between 43 Sticher and 17 Ganal. And there it is.
There it is. And see, it doesn't look like that much. It's not a heavy-duty slash.
It's tiny.
It's tiny, but look at the location of it. It's the second player right there, and it's just below the hands, knocks the stick out, and it's a turnover on that situation, so they have to call that one.
And what I've always been wondering about, and this is where we present you our new and advanced analysis tools, the way referees behave, backtrack, skate, whatever you want to call it, after a face-off. And this is why I brought you the board, because this play originated in a face-off. And I'm always interested in kind of the sight lines the referees are taking, the part of the ice that they need to occupy. And the most important change as regards refereeing probably happened more than a decade ago in switching from the three-man system to the four-man system. If someone out there has never heard of the four-man system, we have four officials on the ice, two referees, two linesmen, linesperson. What's the biggest advantage of the four-man system?
Sight lines, seeing it all. So on the face-off, on the example you just showed, they're not standing out there all looking at the same thing. Those two referees are looking at two very different parts of the ice, even on a face-off, because that's where it starts. And then it builds out from there
right
as soon as play is determined in which way it's going.
So we got a face-off right here, and that's the only thing that I'm going to draw.
Okay.
How are the referees taught to behave right after?
So we got linesman one dropping the puck. We have linesman two over, you know, on the other side. He's scanning for the blue line and he calls.
By the way, science for itself, dropping a puck. It's not that easy.
It's not that easy. No, exactly. So what we would refer to is this is R1, meaning R1's here and he's watching this sight line, which is these players right here. Okay. R2 is going to be somewhere in this area here. and he's scanning this area. So there's a little bit overlap there, and he's scanning these players back here. Now, off this face-off...
And of course, when we talk about sightlines, I think the pucks on my laptop are kind of blocking the sightlines. I'll hold this up a little.
Well, that's what we... That's, as a referee, it's blocked a lot of times, so you got to go on your gut. But considering on this play, the face-off went this way, our penalty was right here. Now, it's going to be the pickup of this guy here, because if I remember right, Manuel was coming from this wing here, skating up with the puck, right? So that's part of his area there. So we would never expect this guy to see it nor call it, because he's watching these players on this side, which is an important thing, because people sometimes, you know, what are they doing and who are they looking at and why did this guy see it and why did this guy not see it?
Knowing about sightlines and their importance is one step in understanding refereeing, and we want to make you understand at home in case you're watching this video. So we're going to turn our attention to another clip that you brought along. It happened in a game between Pustertal and Ljubljana this past year, and it just shows, like, it needs a tiny little whack to cut down the opposition's offense.
Yeah, this one might be a little bit picky, just in the sense that it's not much, and this does occur a lot more than you think. But the thing here is, if you watch the, and we'll show it again here, but the player with
it's,
the puck,
it's Jaka Soja trying to
come across
to
the blue line. Now watch his bottom hand, the Ljubljana's player's bottom hand, right there. See his hand? It moves. It's also part of stick handling, but that is not using your body to defend or any kind of going after the puck. So again, stick horizontal. And the reason that's an important clip is that's going to happen and that's not always going to be called. But when you're the low ref down in that corner, again, like I said earlier, horizontal stick, and there's the player that has possession of the puck, has, he's not on his normal pattern, not on, like, it was interrupted. It's probably easy to say the player that has made that little slash runs the risk versus the player with the puck shouldn't have to take that risk of that's how he's being defended, if that makes sense.
It does, and I think it's a good idea that we've already established sightlines, because the next and the last clip as regards to stick fouls that we're going to look at is concerned with what a ref is seeing. It's taken from a behind-the-goal camera angle. The action happens on the other end of the ice, and it's a call that's really hard to make.
Really
happened
hard.
In the Vienna-Bolzano game. I think Matthias Böhm and Brad McClure were involved in this fourth clip.
Yeah, and this is more what a referee seen at ice level. So although this is just a camera shooting, you probably didn't even see a penalty.
Average fans would go like, what
just happened? Right. And that's why this clip's important, because now when we zoom in on it, but a referee doesn't have this luxury, see, stick right to the hands right there. And, you know, it affected that player taking a shot in that situation, or it can sometimes be a pass. But I think that clip is very important in the sense that a referee down low is a lot different than a fan sitting up high that can see the whole ice sheet. And so it strictly comes down to sight lines. And this is where Tommy's working with the refs all the time, you know, to get up there, get on the play, and what he calls creating angles, because you can't look at something through the back of something. So you got to create angles to it all the time.
Now, the emphasis is on stick fouls. We've had so many changes over the last decade and a half. We had bigger offensive zones after leagues started moving the blue lines. We had the new rule that a goalie is only allowed to pass the puck in certain areas. So every kind of year brings new challenges also for the referees to the table. Is there anything else to be aware of in terms of what might get a bigger deal of, or a greater deal of looks from your side?
Not for the Ice Hockey League. I mean, we have our normal everyday occurrences and what have you. What we do expect, and I would say Bozzano and Salzburg making the finals last year was a good example of disciplined teams. So when we look at somebody like Salzburg, they're, you know, very low on the penalty count. Like, we chart all this every Monday, and we're, you know, do we have a team high on the PK or lower on the PK? And as much as a lot of people think Boatswain's this big rough and tumble team, they're actually not. And body checking is a legal part of the game. So, you know, does Boatswain play the body hard? Yes, but that, provided it's done legally and they do a good job of it, that is fine. If you look at somebody, I'm just talking about Salzburg and Boatswain because they were in the finals and they were good examples of this. Salzburg had a big decor and you know, it wasn't easy getting down low in the attacking zone for the opposing team with that defensive core. So when we sit there in a situation, look, we don't have to adjust right now our rules as much as it's interesting to see how the teams are going to adjust. And then we got to determine what's going to go on.
Please help me out on the equation, because from the outside looking in, even as broadcasters, the past couple of years and maybe even the past decade, it seemed the more skilled a team is, the lesser the probability that they pile up huge amounts of penalties.
Yeah, the golden rule is the more you have puck possession, the less you're going to take penalties, because the vast majority of all penalties occur, unless you're running a pick play or something, are on the team without the puck, like, because they're always trying to defend, right? So when you talk about skill or speed and skill, those are two tough things to defend. And the team that can carry that puck possession for the majority of the time is probably, in most cases, more apt to take less penalties.
Right. This is probably the instance where we have to debut something that I always liked. And I have to explain this to listeners and especially viewers back home. Back in the day, the league website ran a category that was called You Be the Ref. You had one look at an instance, you had one look at a clip, and you were in the referee's shoes. You had to come up with the correct verdict. And I'm bringing this category back because I'm still amazed at how clueless it left me. I'm looking at something that we're seeing all the time, and I don't spot a penalty. But this is the referee's job. They only get one look, and outside of video goal judge review, that's basically it. So your team sent along three clips that we're going to try to dissect here. We get a first look at the clip, and then with the second look, we'll get, again, that kind of circle that highlights where the verdict has taken place. And I have to preface this, I think I'm going to suck at this again, or I'm still sucking at it. So let's just have a look at clip number one. We haven't seen those clips.
I haven't seen them either, so this should be good. I probably miss them as well. Okay, it already happened.
Yeah. Was it an offside?
Yeah.
Yes.
See that in the situation room, you can just tell by, like, that's the old corner of the eye. I knew right away, just because of the, you know, we always have to go back and look as well, because sometimes your corner of your eye doesn't always tell you the truth. But that one, we would go back and look at where was the puck, because we knew that player crossed. When you see a player coming back with a puck and a player going fairly quickly that way, that's Spidey senses right away going, something's not right here.
Spidey senses. Yeah. You see, even though the question mark on our screen is fairly big, ours isn't. It looked like an offside.
See, and see the pucks on the outside of the blue line? Literally another 4 or 5 inches on the inside, and this is a good play now, and he can come across. But the puck never fully crossed the line. And so, you can see the far player, the outside player, he's already offside.
So. And it is an offside. So I guess we're one for one. And something that I always revert back to, and referees, I guess, shouldn't do it, but if there's a ticky-tacky call that could go both sides, how important is it to trust one's gut? Because if it's like really a call that could go both sides, I always revert back to the gut feeling that I had when I saw it live. Does it feel like a goal?
Your gut is normally right. And that is for sure.
Is it something that comes up with the refs as well?
All the time, and there's in a game, we don't discuss this. It's called, you know, a feeling. Now, the feeling for the game can change, and which means your gut reaction has to change too. So I'll give you just a brief example. When we start off a game, we don't want to miss anything early, because that can really run the game down as it goes on if we didn't set the right standard. Late in a game, a 1-1 game late in the third versus an 8-1 game, you have to have a different gut. You have to have a different feeling. You have to have a different spidey sense about you, right? So it's not even about the slash or the hook or the potential, whatever. Where are we at in the game and what does that game need? Now, if we have, like the finals last year, two very disciplined teams, two very well-coached teams, and we know that they're going to play through stuff, it comes out with an ultimate success of unbelievable hockey. But when you play for, you know, September 15th until the end of February, there's nights, all of us, it's a long season and we can't keep that standard up. And we're going to have periods that get away or players that lose focus or the scores dictated it. So your gut has to constantly be changing.
I hope I'm still right on the number. And I think it's something that you mentioned during one of our talks during playoffs, that each and every individual on the ice making calls has to go through 300 separate decisions.
Yeah, and they're all happening in tenths of seconds. They're not happening even in a second. So, and everything is your profiling. So it's what you think you've seen sometimes. And quite honestly, I've been at games where I thought I seen something and I'll go down and talk to officials and then I get to the situation room the next day and realize that I'm wrong because I thought I seen it. So that whole decision-making process can occur in different ways for different people. But the one thing that's consistent is it's like literally in a minute span, how many decisions they've had to make. Both too, Martin, what people forget with hockey is it's a very fast pace game on a very small ice sheet. And just their ability to comprehend the game and move into a position to not get ran over or to get hit themselves without ever being able to think about it. Because if they're thinking about their positioning, they're not thinking about the game.
Now we're one for one as regards making the right call in our UB the ref category. Two more clips to go. I highly doubt that I'm going to go 3 for 3. But let's find out what the second clip is that you and your team brought along. Oh my. I guess this is a clip they brought along that one might assume that it's a penalty. But is it a penalty on the offensive player?
I think the situation room set us both up on this. And I'll tell you why. That is 100% the judgment of the referee based on his sight line. From that camera angle, this side of the ice, looking at the play, probably not a penalty.
Okay, question marks going to go around. We'll have the solution right here. What happened here?
The left hand, the wraparound. The referee's on the side. He sees the left arm come around. He sees the wraparound. So this is actually a great clip, and we'll probably be using something like this. I don't know about this clip at the coaches' meeting. Captain's, is this a penalty? But there's even more to this than is that a penalty? Because that's actually a penalty shot.
It is?
Yep, because okay. There was nobody between that attacking player and the goalie. So you got to really make a big call there on it's either nothing, and if you're in Sheikhus Ferivar, the fans are going to be booing and hissing, and they're not going to be happy
great
about
place,
it if you call nothing.
Probably a hard place for referees.
Hard place. And if you do call a penalty, it's actually a penalty shot, and the fans are going to be really happy in Sheikhus Ferivar.
I was thinking, too, that they're setting us up and that it had to be some infraction from maybe the offensive player, but...
No, like, this is a thing that is crazy about the game of hockey. Is that a penalty or is that not a penalty? From this side of the ice, in my opinion, in my judgment, no. From the other side of the ice...
But if we can have another look at it, because I think it's important to work out where the referee is standing. He's on the other side of the ice.
That's the most important thing of this.
Behind the goal.
Yeah. And he's seen... Just watch the Ljubljana player's left arm... And see the referee, and now he's actually right across. Like, he's not in front, he's on the side. He's just seeing that arm come around and then that player going down. And so it's no different when I was talking about slashing. Sometimes it's what position have you put yourself in there? So that is strictly a play based on the referee's sight line, and that was his judgment. So I'm not saying the referee was wrong. What I'm saying is from that side of the ice and what the view he had, for sure, it could be a penalty. From our view on sitting on the other side with the camera there, it's not a penalty. That's how crazy it is sometimes.
So there you go. I've already proven my cluelessness. Maybe I can go 2 for 1. There's a third example of you be the ref.
Got it?
Jesus.
High stick.
No chance. Because I remember talking to referees and they're taught not to watch the puck, which is awfully hard because the natural focus for me is watching the puck and what happens with it. But I mean, let's have a look what would really happen.
Yeah, but
I wouldn't have had a chance to really get this right.
Well, and once it's zoomed in, it's easy, really easy. Right there. That's how fast it happens.
Jesus, I could have probably
So it's right at the face-off dot there. Even with the highlight, sometimes it's a little hard to tell, but it happens right at that dot. But this is another Situation Room did a great job of sending these clips because this is one that shows
Hats
how quick this really occurs in that fast. Now,
and of course, the puck goes the other way. You might miss the player's face.
100%. Yeah, we always say to the referees, the puck's never got a penalty. Don't watch the puck. You're not worried about the puck, which goes into the case of goals. Why did the referee not see it? Well, we've taught them not to watch the puck because it doesn't get the penalty. There's a great example. If they're watching the puck, they're not seeing that call. But this is also a good example to take the game a bit deeper and a bit further. From a referee standpoint, that's obviously what we're looking at right now. We're sitting there going, okay, in this case, they did catch that high stick. We're showing that it happens fast. It's quick. Bang, bang, bang. From a Situation Room standpoint, we sit there and break that clip down even further now, and we sit there and go, did the stick for sure get that player? Who is that player that got high sticked? Does he have a tendency to do this all the time or not? In this case, I remember that play now, and I want to say it was the captain of Vienna, who is not a person that's, we call him head bobbers, but he's not a head bobber. So that was a legit high stick. But in some situations, we always talk from a referee standpoint of, you know, what is the player, let's say, without the puck doing? But we never talk about what is the player with the puck or the player, the other opponent doing, because players are, these are professionals. They know how to draw referees into penalties as well. It can go both ways, right? And that's really hard for referee to stay away from. Say that stick didn't get up there, but he does this. You know,
or it got close,
and this is where the Situation Room sits there. So we have a lot of lists going. We and there's no great science to this, but we have the head bobber list. We have the we call them the soft players, the players that go down soft all the time, because come playoff time,
you
we
need
have
to know
who goes
down.
And
yeah,
you know what? Maybe that soft player did get hooked, but too bad, too sad, because he's been going down soft for 6 months. We're not giving him that. We're not, and we have to work with these referees. So you really have to learn tendencies of players. And then on the flip side, we have a player that battles through everything, never goes through. If he give up, or not give up, but if he got hooked and things maneuvered around, he probably legitimately got hooked because this player battles through everything, right? And then we have our what we call a high alert list, which means those are the players that play on the edge all the time, which is fine. We're not condoning that, but we have to keep a closer eye.
Just to put a face on a high alert player, who would be... Or who would have been, maybe if he's out of the league, who would have been a high alert player?
Actually, high alert players aren't somebody that stays on a list and the list stays all year. So Martin Vanner doesn't get on the list on September 15th and
probably
then he's
not
on it. So if Martin Vanner's the high alert guy from a game based on September 15th, we're going to track him for at least a couple weeks. And I'll give you a good example why. And a lot of times, this is what people don't realize with the Situation Room. Sure, DOPS is down. Our suspensions are down. You know, it's not like the good old days of, you know, big suspensions and a lot of suspensions because, well, two reasons. Suspension amounts are down because there's also fines, which wasn't the case back in the day. But more importantly, and this is what fans never see, will never know, the amount of work we're doing with the coaches so the coaches can do the work with the players and in some cases directly with the players. So you're Martin Fanner, I'm the coach. Martin's been, you know, you're a third or fourth liner. You're an energy player for us, and you haven't been doing much. I come in, I ride you. Martin, we need more energy. All of a sudden, in you know, November, we could see Martin Fanner from last game to this game change. And we're like, what got into Martin? Sometimes it's just a matter of phoning the coach after or the next day saying, are you riding Martin a bit? We're seeing a different tendency here. And that's fine. We don't have to phone to find that out unless he's running, like he's borderline, you know, something for DOPS or he took two or three penalties that night. We've seen something different. That's the high alert. And it's changing all the time. And it changes throughout a season. So, you know, it's not a case of, you know, you're on a bad boy list and you're there forever. It really does move.
Interesting point. And, you know, I've never been shy In terms of embarrassing myself, so going one out of three for you be the ref, I guess it's kind of success. But then again, I need to go back to the drawing board. But we'll have this category again here on Win Today Hockey Clock once you return.
Well, and I think it's a great opportunity for fans to see the game. We don't expect the fans to understand, you know, what a referee goes through, and definitely not asking for sympathy or anything like that. But it is important to know that there is a complexity to it all.
And you got one shot.
One shot. And it's also a complexity for the players, because as we change or evolve or move the game, it's a big engine. We're moving a lot of players, you know, 300-400 players. We're moving, you know, 15 referees. We're moving everything, and it all has to collectively go together. So, you know, this whole, it's a system that we have to work with all the time. And it's important the fans understand that.
You know what? Another big engine, and that kind of brings me to our last topic, is the Champions Hockey League, because there are going to be some massive rule changes in the upcoming Champions Hockey League campaign. And we brought along a couple of those rule changes. You can read them on the screen right now. At the point of this recording, the Champions Hockey League season hasn't started yet, but we will have had the first couple of games. And if we just turn our attention to the major rule changes, I'd like to take the quote from the bottom. It's from the Champions Hockey League CEO, Martin Baumann. He says, "The right balance of innovation, excitement, and credibility." Could you run me through the three rule changes that will probably affect the Champions Hockey League games in a big way?
Certainly. And I'll just go back one step to the history of this, because this has been being worked on for 3 years to get to the point where we're at now with the Champions Hockey League, because this all started trying to figure out, when a team gets a penalty, we change the rules. Now you're allowed to ice the puck. And we went back in history, we ran 3 years of analysis and stats, and we actually got to a point, and the decision was made actually in our playoffs last year through a group effort that, you know, we have other things that will come along with the game as well in following years. But this season, we thought this was the perfect season to bring out, basically, if you're on a power play and you score, the other team obviously is shorthanded. Under normal circumstances, that team that's shorthanded gets a player with a box. The minor penalty I'm talking about.
So you get the 2-minute penalty, you score after 15 seconds. So you're losing basically 105 seconds of the man advantage.
Right. And so now that's not the case. A 2-minute penalty is exactly like a 5-minute penalty, in the sense that if a team scores, it's being served regardless. It's actually not a new rule. It actually, back up until the 1960s, that's how hockey was played, until Montreal Canadiens had this dominating team, and it actually changed in the 60s and went to the way we've known it in later years. So actually, we repeated history. We went back and said, no, a 2-minute is a full 2-minute no matter what, just like a 5-minute penalty is.
But the caveat?
The caveat, and this is the one that I don't know how many years I've been trying to figure out how we can fix the ability to allow a team to ice the puck when they're shorthanded, because to me, it does not add any real excitement for the fans to see a puck shot 200 feet, 200 feet, 200 feet on the penalty kill. But we could never, or I couldn't come up with anything, because what do we do in the second period? Long line change. How do we get players off the ice? There's a safety component to all this. This is where we are today. We're going to try to get coaches and players to think a little bit differently on the penalty kill. For sure, they have the ability to shoot at 200 feet. They have the ability to ice it. But what we want, especially late in the third period or any time in the game, but you're down 3-2 and you're on the penalty kill. If you score shorthanded, you get the goal and you get your guy out of the box. He comes out of the penalty's over if you score shorthanded.
So there's the incentive. And the funny thing is, I had at the start of the season, Thomas Raffe here on Winter Day Hockey Clock, and I asked him about the new Champions Hockey League rules. And he said, it's great because it finally incentivizes scoring on the PK.
And that's what we're trying to achieve. Now, our first Champions League game is coming up here. And in my heart and my gut, and I've been through this, I've ran all the stats, and a real interesting stat to this is the first thing the fans think of, because we've read it on blogs, we've read it on every, you know, all around Europe, is all these goals. Well, let's look at stats that don't lie. The average stat for a team, their scoring percentage on the power play is 17%. That's all teams, that's everybody. But a really good team runs a 20% power play scoring percentage. That means one in every five penalties or power plays they get, they score once. That's based on stats, obviously. But that those are true stats for the past three seasons. Now, when we looked at major penalties for the last 3 years, how many times were there multiple goals, meaning more than one goal? Very rare. So people really think, oh, we're going to have all this scoring. Yeah, but that's what, we won't have this right off. It's not what people think off the bat, but we have to change the game. We have to, it's what I was saying, referring to earlier, change the players' thoughts, change the coaches' thoughts and stuff.
Getting back to moving the blue lines, everybody thought there'd be a scoring explosion, and I think it's been a gradual incline, but no,
not
far, far and away from an explosion.
Yeah, goalies aren't going to like, you know, hockey operations people in any league, because there's the old saying, coaches coach defense, and fans want offense. They want goals.
But look at the National Football League, what they did. I mean, basically, they tied the defense's hand behind their backs, but scoring has gone up, and attendance has been record-setting and viewership. So.
Well, we think this is going to change the game, and we think the getting relief in the penalty kill is going to be the one that's a lot bigger than being able to score multiple goals on a power play. The reason we didn't bring it in the Ice League this year is we want to run numbers and run everything for a year. Maybe it's a complete fail, and I'll take the hit for that. But I don't, in my heart, I've ran too much to know. I really truly believe this is going to work. And I, in my heart, and I can't really state it this time, but this is the start of more to come, meaning the next season. And the Ice League will probably trail. Ice League and all the other leagues will trail by 1 year, and we're using the Champions League as the trial product.
But just around this rules conversation out, a power play is now a full 2 minutes unless there's a shorthanded goal scored. That kills off the penalty. What happens with the delay penalty?
Exact same thing. So I got my arm up. I'm the referee, and the team, you know, they're playing 6-on-5 because they pulled their goalie.
Position.
Right, and now the team has pulled their goalie and they score, it's still a penalty. 2 minutes is just like if it was a 5 minute, that would still be a penalty. 2 minutes is, it's still a penalty. So, you know, it more incentive, it's easy to say more incentive to score. Tell me a coach or player that doesn't have as much incentive
right,
as they can
be
to score.
In everyday practice, because now there's a real reason to practice 6-on-5.
There's a reason to practice 6-on-5. There's a reason, like on a penalty, when you're killing a penalty,
or
in my little world,
even more
anyhow, each coach will do different things. But let's take the NHL as an example. I don't want to say any teams in our own league. Edmonton Oilers are down 3-2 in the third period. You wouldn't see Connor McDavid on the penalty kill. He logs a lot of ice time already. He's on the power play, blah, blah, blah. Depending on the game, if they haven't had two, you know, on his ice time and everything else, they're down 3-2. You're probably going to see
some high-profile scores.
Scores on the ice. What do they have to lose? They're down 3-2. If they can score, they tied it up. And two, they get their guy out of the box. So if you, again, go back in history, people don't realize Wayne Gretzky used to kill penalties. Edmonton Oilers had that dynamite of a team. He didn't do it all the time, but in special circumstances, Wayne Gretzky would be on the ice. In Pittsburgh, Mary Lou Lemieux would be on the ice. I'm dating myself because that's back when I was on the ice too, but you know, you sit there and you know, all these things are coming from history for me anyhow. That's, you know, it's not like we sit there and throw darts at a dartboard and hope. You have to analyze the game in the 80s, the 90s, and then you have to take it all the way up to where are we today. We don't have many penalties anymore, Martin. We don't have a lot of power play opportunities. So now we got to make the most of it, both on the power play and the penalty kill.
And I got to correct myself. Of course, 6-on-5 is practiced a lot because of empty net situations, but now it kind of incentivizes getting the right people out fast, depending on the personality on the ice. So it's going to be interesting. And one last thing to really round this out and close this out is you're always talking about we. And I don't think fans are aware enough of how big an influence the Winter Day Ice Hockey League has indeed on the Champions Hockey League, as funny as it may sound. How does that working relationship work?
Well, we do the whole kind of that hands-on hockey operations. Like, you know, the Champions League has their employees, you know, in Switzerland, they do a marvelous job, but behind the scenes, you know, if it stops, that's us. Game officials, that's us. Like, meaning we are still helping the Champions League on all that. So right from its inception, which started as a nothing more than an idea coming out of a meeting in Spain 9-10 years ago to today, been there from, let's call it, the ground floor up. So
quite a journey.
Quite a journey. And from my standpoint, it is really good hockey. If anybody's ever been able to see the Champions League final, it ranks right up there with any final you're ever going to see anywhere. Like, it's that incredible. And the product itself is, it's a great product. And you know, the Innsbruck fans are going to be fortunate enough to witness it for the first time themselves. This season, the Bozen fans and the Salzburg fans have seen it before. And it's kind of cool in the sense that, you know, you play the same teams in a small league over and over again, and now you get to see teams from other leagues and can kind of compare yourself to where are we with the other leagues.
Interesting. We're going to do this again, I guess, a month or two from now. We're going to try to be as transparent as possible. So that goes out to all the viewers out there and, of course, to all the listeners. If there's something that really interests you, if there's a suspension and the duration you're not agreeing with, or if there's a clip that you want us to dissect, send it along. Send it to our personal social media, send it to, there are ways to get our attention. And of course, we'll post something on social media for you to get active. So make this kind of podcast with Live Sites your podcast, give us your ideas, and we'll try to be as transparent as possible as regards everything that happens in a situation room with the ops right here on Win Today Hockey O'Clock. As always, pleasure talking to you. Looking forward to having more of these kind of things.
Perfect. Thanks, Martin, and thanks for having me, and I'm sure you feel the same way. Can't wait to get back in the ice-cold arenas after all this heat.
Let's get this started. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Win Today Hockey O'Clock.
In diesem Gespräch eröffnet jener Spieler seinem Teammanager:
Er will den Vertrag kündigen.
Und aus dem Team ausscheiden.
Er ist drangsaliert worden vor dem Spiel.
Er kann kaum glauben, was er da zu hören bekommt.
Und auch mit der wirklich schärferen Androhung von Gewalt.
Von seinen eigenen Mannschaftskollegen.
Der hat gezittert vor Angst.
Michael Fuchs kommt zur schaurigen Erkenntnis. Mitglieder seiner eigenen Mannschaft sind Teil eines Komplotts zur Spielmanipulation.
Win Today Hockey O'Clock.
Das war ein Auszug aus Falsches Spiel, ein Podcast von Win Today, der sich der Wettspielmanipulation und dem Kampf gegen die Wettmafia, dem organisierten Verbrechen diesbezüglich, wenn man so will, auch widmet. Und dass es diese Wettspielmafia auch so schwierig wie möglich hat, dafür zeichnet sich der Mann verantwortlich, der mir jetzt gegenüber sitzt hier bei Winter Day Hockey O'Clock. Das ist Lukas Gradke und du bist von Beruf Buchmacher. Und das ist ein Gespräch, auf das ich mich persönlich sehr gefreut habe, weil man diesen Beruf vielleicht so gar nicht auf der Rechnung hat. Ist aber einer der ältesten auch des Planeten ist, wenn man so will, oder zumindest der organisierten Arbeit. Bevor ich mich um Kopf und Kragen rede, erstmal schön, Lukas, dass du dir die Zeit nimmst, hier bei Winter Day Hockey O'Clock ein paar Fragen zur Buchmacherei und darüber hinaus zu beantworten.
Vielen Dank für die Einladung.
Eines der ältesten Gewerbe der Welt. Ich möchte jetzt das nicht das andere nennen, das gemeinhin als ältestes der Welt bezeichnet wird, aber Sport und Sportwetten und die Buchmacherei, die gehen schon sehr weit zurück. Von was für einem Zeitraum sprechen wir da?
Oh, das ist eine ausgezeichnete Frage. Ich würde fast meinen, dass das muss so im zweiten Jahrhundert schon bereits stattgefunden haben in etwa. Es stellt sich quasi da der grundlegenden Frage, wer ist besser oder wer macht was besser? Das ist natürlich unter zwei Kontrahenten, ist das einfach zum Ausmachen, wer besser ist. Da bräuchte es vielleicht einen dritten Unabhängigen, der quasi die Stärkeneinschätzung übernimmt und daraufhin die Wetten. Und diese Fragestellung gab es quasi schon immer. Wer ist stärker, wer ist schneller in irgendetwas, wer springt weiter, wer, weiß ich nicht, wirft den Stein weiter als der andere. Und damit beschäftigt sich die Buchmacherei natürlich grundlegend von Anfang an.
Also wir blicken mal lockerflockiger auf 1800 Jahre and counting zurück, die es die Buchmacherei gibt. Aber wenn wir jetzt vielleicht auch dich haben, der in dieser Branche auch gelandet ist, wie wird man Buchmacher? Mhm.
Grundlegend für die Allgemeinheit kann ich das natürlich nicht aussprechen. Ich kann nur von meinen Erfahrungswerten...
Also es gibt keine vorgezeichneten Wege. Es ist wahrscheinlich wie in der Medienbranche, dass jeder was werden kann, wenn er gut in dem ist, was er macht. Aber ohne dich jetzt unterbrechen zu wollen.
Grundlegend ist es so, bei mir ist schon immer ein sehr, sehr starkes Interessensfeld einhergegangen an Sportereignissen, Sportresultaten. Das muss so ungefähr 1994 bereits bei mir angefangen mit der Weltmeisterschaft in den USA. Man hat das gebannt vom Fernseher mitverfolgt. Und dann hatte ich 2003 die Möglichkeit, bei einem Wettanbieter Fuß zu fassen. Und seitdem hat mich die Branche nicht losgelassen und habe dort 16 Jahre als Buchmacher verbringen dürfen.
Was mich persönlich so fasziniert, und gerade wenn man den Blick nach Nordamerika wagt und auch sieht, wie allgegenwärtig manche Sportsbooks mittlerweile in den Sportarten sind, wie sich zum Beispiel auch die National Football League demgegenüber geöffnet hat. Wir sprechen von hochkomplexen Spielen, Football, Eishockey, Basketball mit Tausenden und Abertausenden von Variablen, die aber in irgendeiner Art und Weise quantifizierbar gemacht werden müssen. Vulgo, die Quote. Wie kommt man zu einer Quote?
Dazu muss man grundlegend verstehen, was drückt denn eine Quote eigentlich aus? Und das ist ziemlich einfach erklärt. Es ist nicht mehr oder weniger als der Ausdruck darüber, über den wohlmöglichen Ausgang eines Ereignisses. Und das wird ausgedrückt durch die Meinung des Buchmachers. Wie entsteht diese Quote? Es sind zwar immer die gleichen Grundrezepturen. Es ist in erster Linie, man braucht natürlich eine statistische Auswertung im direkten Head-to-Head-Duell zum Beispiel zwischen zwei Kontrahenten. Dann natürlich individuelle Spielerstärken werden berücksichtigt in der Wahrscheinlichkeitsberechnung für den womöglichen Ausgang. Aktuelle Formverläufe sind extremst wichtig und dann natürlich am Matchtag selber, weil bis kurz vor Spielanfang steht oft der endgültige Kader nicht zur Verfügung. Das heißt natürlich Spielerverletzungen oder individuelle Formverläufe oder Krankheitsbilder. Vielleicht ist ein Spieler in der Früh extremst verkühlt. Das sind alles Faktoren, die können da mit einfließen. Und all diese Grundfaktoren, daraus wird dann eine Quote erstellt.
Zwar sind wir schon der Anspruch von Win Today Hockey O'Clock, auch den Horizont von Sportfans im Allgemeinen und Eishockeyfans im Speziellen auch zu erweitern. Aber bekommt ja nicht alle heilige Zeiten die Gelegenheit, auch da mal wirklich bei diesem Thema nachzuforschen. Nachdem ich mich in puncto Wahrscheinlichkeitsrechnung bei meiner Matura um Kopf und Kragen geredet hatte, weil ich tatsächlich Mathe mündlich maturiert hatte und dort aber vielleicht am wenigsten sattelfest war. Wie sattelfest sollte man beim Thema Wahrscheinlichkeitsrechnung sein, wenn man den Weg in die Buchmacherei anstrebt?
Ist natürlich von Vorteil, wenn man zahlenaffin ist und ein natürliches Gespür dann tatsächlich für Stärkeneinschätzung und die dahin eingehende Wahrscheinlichkeit dann für einen unmöglichen Ausgang. Eine gewisse Affinität ist durchaus von Vorteil.
Du hast die ganzen Faktoren angefügt und angeführt, die in eine Quotenerhebung fließen. Inwieweit unterscheidet sich, um vielleicht die populärste Sportart auch Europas herzunehmen, Fußball vom Eishockey? Gibt es da Schema F, das man in jedem Sport verwendet, oder gibt es da völlig unterschiedliche Herangehensweisen?
Nein, das ist ein sehr, sehr gutes Beispiel, also der direkte Vergleich Fußball mit Eishockey. Wenn man es einfach in der Summe nimmt, beim Eishockey finden halt viel, viel weniger Unentschieden zum Beispiel statt als beim Fußball. Dahingehend hat man natürlich ein anderes insgesamt Gesamtbild für die Basisquote 1x2 zum Beispiel. Das X ist natürlich deutlich höher beim Eishockey als beim Fußball. Daraufhin sind die Quoten auf die Heimmannschaft und auf die Auswärtsmannschaft natürlich nicht 1:1 umzurechnen wie beim Fußball. Das ist hier ein bisschen anders zu behandeln.
Darf man in einem anderen Berufszweig sehr intensiv auch mit American Football beschäftigen, dort vor allem mit der National Football League. Und für all diejenigen, die vielleicht auch dem Football frönen möchten, es gibt in der Winterday Podcast Familie auch einen wunderbaren Football Podcast, der nennt sich natürlich Winterday Football O'Clock. Dort steht einmal wöchentlich ein österreichischer NFLer mit Bernhard Seikowitz tatsächlich Rede und Antwort. Und ich habe vor Jahren mal gelesen, wenn man keine Ahnung vom Wetten hat, dann sollte man bei einem American Football Spiel einfach auf 20-17 wetten. Das ist quasi statistisch gesehen hinsichtlich der Wahrscheinlichkeit das wahrscheinlichste aller Ergebnisse. Gibt so einen Wett einfach auf dieses Ergebnis im Eishockey, oder ist es da zu schwer zu predikten?
Beim Eishockey ist es ein bisschen deutlich schwieriger als natürlich beim Fußball. Vor allem Jeder kennt das im Schlussdrittel ist einfach in die Phase, wenn eine Powerplay-Situation, also wenn ein Tor benötigt wird. Das hat natürlich ein ganz anderes Momentum als beim Fußball, wenn ein Tor benötigt wird.
Was spannend ist, ich erinnere mich, und darf mich schon länger ja auch ein klein wenig mit dem Thema beschäftigen, an ein Gespräch und bilde mir ein, dass mir jemand gesagt hat, dass zur Quotenerhebung und zur Live-Quotenerhebung tatsächlich Menschen im Stadion sitzen oder in der Halle und mittracken, was beim Spielgeschehen passiert. Und ich stelle mir das halt irgendwie ganz, ganz lustig vor, dass man da oben irgendwo in der Halle sitzt und neben einem fährt einer wie wahnsinnig auf einem Tablet hin und her und rauf und runter. Gibt es diese Leute tatsächlich?
Wir haben tatsächlich Vertragspartner, die in den Stadien sitzen, die statistischen Gegebenheiten auffassen und festhalten. Das ist nicht nur für das Live-Spiel an sich wichtig und interessant, das ist allen voran für die Folgenquotierungen wichtig, das heißt für die nächsten Spiele. Und hierbei wird zum Beispiel auch ausgewertet, wie hat ein Einzelspieler performt. War die Pass-Ratio akkurat genug in dieser Partie? Ist die stark abweichend von den letzten 6 Spielen? Und hin und daraufhin kann sie natürlich eine Formkurve abbilden. Und das fließt dann alles ins Quotenbild für zukünftige Events mit ein.
Wir haben über die Variablen gesprochen und die Parameter, die bei sowas einfließen. Wie viele Kennzahlen, Kategorien, verschiedene Werte gibt es tatsächlich, die dann am Ende durch eine Quote abgebildet werden?
Das ist jetzt sehr, sehr schwer in einer Zahl auszudrücken.
Kriegst du nur die schweren Fragen hier.
Ausgezeichnet. Auf der einen Seite, man bekommt natürlich mit den Jahren als Buchmacher bekommt man ein grundlegendes Gespür. Das bedeutet im Umkehrschluss, die statistische Auswertung muss nicht mehr so intensiv betrieben werden wie am Anfang. Man erhält einfach ein automatisches Gefühl. Das erhält höchstwahrscheinlich auch der Wetter, der sich öfters mit der Materie auseinandersetzt, der bekommt auch automatisch ein Gefühl für Stärkeneinschätzung. Genauso ist es beim Buchmacher. Aber prinzipiell, wie vorher schon erwähnt, es sind quasi immer diese 4 Grundsäulen. Es ist die historisch-statistische Auswertung und die aktuelle Formkurve ist einfach schlichtweg wichtig.
Jetzt haben wir vor unserem Gespräch den Trailer zu Falsches Spiel gehört, Wettspielmanipulationen. Ist das ein Thema im Eishockey? Also mir ist es noch nicht zuteil geworden. Ist es ein Thema oder ist die Prävention vielleicht auch ob der ganzen anderen Skandale so weit fortgeschritten, dass es auch weiterhin kein Thema sein wird? Oder muss man da eh ständig auf den Zehenspitzen sein, weil es passieren könnte?
Hierbei muss man grundlegend sagen, das gilt eigentlich durch die Bank für alle Sportarten. Also aufmerksam muss man auf alle Sportarten sein. Ich könnte jetzt nicht aussprechen, dass es mehr oder weniger risikobehaftet ist. Es ist quasi immer das Gleiche. Bitte, wenn Verdacht in diese Richtung besteht, natürlich auch von außen an die zuständigen Stellen melden. Das Ganze kann nur funktionieren, indem man sich gegenseitig in diese Richtung informiert. Das ist auf der einen Seite der Fan, der Kunde, der solche Sachen mitbekommt, und auf der anderen Seite wir als Anbieter müssen uns natürlich unverhältnismäßig merkwürdige Einsatzverhalten, Wettverhalten natürlich, was halt, wo das Pegel anschlägt und was komplett atypisch ist zum normalen Betrieb, da besteht natürlich dann Verdacht, da wird man weiter investigieren und von dem Punkt muss man dann weiter ansetzen.
Und das ist deswegen auch spannend und kann ich allen zu Hause tatsächlich nur ans Herz legen, sich diese Serie anzuhören, in welchen unterschiedlichen Bereichen es das schon gab oder wo es Verdachtsmomente auch gab. Wir haben Fußball, unterklassiger Fußball, wir haben Tennis, es geht um Basketball. Also wer denkt, Eishockey ist da, sag ich mal, die Insel der Seligen, keine Ahnung, müsste ich oder würde ich mich in die Schuhe eines Wettmafiosi versetzen. Ich würde einfach den Goalie kaufen und ihm sagen, du, beim Eishockey kriegst 50 Schüsse aufs Tor. Gegentore können sehr blöd aussehen. Dementsprechend lass da einfach ein paar rein. Nicht, dass wir jetzt irgendwie Leuten da draußen und vor allem Goalies da draußen, bitte nicht, die Anweisung geben wollen, wie sie sich dann irgendwie für die Wettspielmafia öffnen. Aber wäre es so leicht, ein Eishockeyspiel mit einer Einzelperson wie eben dem Goalie, der sehr großen Einfluss auf ein Spiel hat, zu manipulieren?
Ich muss sagen, das kann ich so nicht bestätigen, weil ich auch selbst in diese Sache nicht involviert bin. Die Möglichkeit wird es wahrscheinlich geben. Auch hierbei ist es eben wichtig, dass man sich gegenseitig informiert und denen einfach nachgehen kann. Weil wenn keiner was sagt und jeder wegschaut, haben wir einfach schlichtweg keine sichere Eventlandschaft, Wettlandschaft, und das Ganze muss schlichtweg einfach fair für uns alle bleiben, und das geht nur, wenn der Wettkampfsport nicht beeinflusst ist durch kriminelle Machenschaften oder Energien in die Richtung.
Ich freue mich auch deswegen, mit dir plaudern zu dürfen, weil es gerade im englischsprachigen Bereich, und das bringt mich dann auch wieder zurück zu Nordamerika, viele Podcasts gibt, die mit Sportsbooks zusammenarbeiten. Und einer meiner Lieblingspodcasts, der hat ein reguläres Segment, wo ein Journalist, Schreiberling, auch mit Affinität in Richtung Sportwetten regelmäßig vorkommt und dann so Best-Value-Geschichten auflistet, so quasi... Fünf der letzten sechs Mal war das Over-Under an Toren bei der Avalanche 5,5. Und es ist jedes Mal, oder es war immer 5,5, und fünf der letzten sechs Male ist drüber gegangen. Gibt sowas im heimischen, also gibt's sowas wie Best-Value-Wetten oder sind das dann, sage ich mal, temporäre Beobachtungen?
Da muss ich zugeben, da muss man vielleicht zwei Schienen oder zwei Begriffe für diese Best Value.
Das war jetzt viel vermengt, deswegen gut, dass du es auseinander dividierst.
Auf der einen Seite ist natürlich eine Best Value Quote oder ja, Best Value Odds ist natürlich im direkten Vergleich vielleicht zur Konkurrenz, wenn ich schlichtweg sehe, Anbieter B hat eine weitaus höhere Quote auf den gleichen Ausgang. Könnte das eine Best-Value-Bet natürlich darstellen. Auf der anderen Seite darf man nicht vergessen, die Abbildung von Quoten. Das ist schlichtweg nur die Meinung über den wohlmöglichen Ausgang eines Ereignisses. Das heißt natürlich, wenn man tief in der Materie drin ist und sich stark mit den Sportereignissen beschäftigt, kann man tatsächlich, wenn man ein gutes Gespür dafür hat, wohlmöglich das akkurater einschätzen oder besser predikten, als die Quote vielleicht zum Ausdruck bringt.
Wieder zurückgehend, und das bringt mich dann auch schon langsam ans Ende unseres Gesprächs, auf den nordamerikanischen Markt. Dort scheint es mir so, sind diese Over-Under-Wetten sehr beliebt. Mhm. Also wie viele Siege hat eine Mannschaft am Ende der Saison am Konto stehend, da heißt es dann 17,5. Und dann kann man entweder das Under nehmen, sprich die werden 17 Mal oder weniger gewinnen, oder das Over heißt, sie werden 18 Mal oder häufiger gewinnen. Gibt's diesbezüglich für einen Buchmacher die perfekte Quote, wo man halt irgendwie versucht, es so zu, in Anführungszeichen, zu steuern, dass es genug Action auf beiden Seiten gibt?
Das ist schön ausgedrückt. Das ist dann quasi das Prinzip.
Der heilige Gral des Buchmachers.
Der heilige Gral des Buchmachers. Er versucht tatsächlich anhand der Einsätze ein Buch zu machen, wie der Begriff so schön sagt. Und das versucht man natürlich durch Quotenänderungen, durch das Abbilden einer akkuraten Stärkeneinschätzung. Und schlussendlich liegt es aber schlichtweg beim Kunden, ob er sich für Seite A oder B entscheidet. Am Ende des Tages, wenn wir ehrlich sind, das Resultat zeigt uns dann, wer am Ende eigentlich quasi recht gehabt hat.
Und letztlich ist es nie verkehrt, bei seriösen Wettanbietern dann tatsächlich auch eine Wette zu platzieren. Das ist bei Winterday der Fall. Durfte sehr, sehr viel lernen. Freue mich außerordentlich, dass du so lange Zeit genommen hast, um auch Einblicke zu geben in einen Bereich, der vielleicht nie ganz so an die Öffentlichkeit kommt. Und hoffe, dass das nicht das letzte Mal geblieben ist. Vielen lieben Dank.
Hat mich sehr gefreut.
Winterday Hockey. Oh Gott.
Kurz durchatmen bei diesem Wahnsinn. Und das ging rasend schnell. Der Traum vom Finale ist erfüllt. Mittendrin statt nur dabei. Fans, stimmungsvoll und hoffnungsfroh. Nice move.